It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we meet a behavioral ecologist who researches why mammals make the decisions they do. And our first animal behavior class is underway at UW-Eau Claire with study subjects like dogs, Madagascar hissing cockroaches, and crawfish. Call in with questions and comments about animal behavior, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology at UW-Eau Claire. Jen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
What questions are your students most interested in answering about animal behavior?
That is the question of the day. So they're very, very interested in trying to figure out the hidden worlds of animals. And they generally use two different approaches. They're trying to understand how different types of behaviors work and also why animals do what they do in an evolutionary sense.
How complex are animals' thoughts and you know, what they do, when they do it? What is instinct? What is their own thinking and reasoning?
Right. And that is something that we wrestle with a lot at the beginning of this course. So, the animal behavior course has not been taught for quite some time at UW-Eau Claire. And so we started off the semester thinking about nature versus nurture. And actually, through their projects on dogs, they discovered that it's a combination of these two things. So there are various aspects of behavior that are certainly learned and develop across a lifespan. But there are also differences based on selective breeding, artificial breeding that humans have imposed upon these animals. And so we see different breed types behaving differently as well.
What are some of the experiments that you're able to do with the students that are able to lead them into this balance of nature versus nurture?
Right. So recently we went to Embark, which is a dog training facility that's right here in Eau Claire. And the students went, we brought community members in. There were dogs from all over the town, and they came in, and the researchers, which are our students, were doing these experiments based on dogs are motivated by food. I think we all like to eat, and dogs included. And we asked whether the dogs could understand human pointing. So it's a pretty simple test. show them food, get them understanding where to go and search for this hidden treat in a bucket. And then we ratchet it up so it gets more and more complicated, and then eventually ask, in the absence of seeing where the food goes, are the dogs able to understand human social pointing? And many of them do.
And they have such persistence in accomplishing something. Sometimes I just marvel at their focus. Where does that come from?
Absolutely. One of the things that we discovered in this work is that some dogs have a lot more focus than others. And we really, and I think that's generally, this is happening with these dogs. It's a major theme in my research studies out in nature on squirrels and other kinds of animals as well, where these individual differences emerge. So from animal behavior perspective, rather than it being noise, we're incredibly interested in explaining what is it about the life experience of an individual animal? What is it about how they've been, over evolutionary time favored to do certain things? And it comes back to this nature versus nurture combination oftentimes.
We're talking about animal behavior with Jen Smith, assistant professor and behavioral ecologist at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in with your questions and comments about animal behavior and what you wonder. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen, in people, trauma at a young age, it increases the risk of adverse effects later in life. How well does research of mammal behavior help better understand what people go through?
It helps us a lot. So people are long-lived. We're challenging to study, and sometimes it's, you know, not ethical to ask certain questions. As a behavioral ecologist, we can actually go and look at many, many different animals all at once experiencing many different types of factors. So we saw in the dog study some differences in terms of raising environment, whether dogs were rescued and grew up, you know, without exposure to humans compared to those that are experiencing a consistent home. And, you know, that can influence the outcomes of some of these tests. We also see a lot of this in my squirrel research out in California, where squirrels that are growing up in an area where they're exposed to humans early in life are incredibly different later in life than those that are in a more pristine or natural situation. And this has implications for thinking about the life course and how many of these animals are resilient. They'll actually shift their behavioral decisions based on what they experience early in life. So it used to be thought that exposure to adversity is harmful, but actually we're seeing, I mean, of course it is in the short term, but our research across social mammals has really shown that there are many ways that animals, including ourselves, can be resilient and shift how we approach the world based on these early experiences. It's a little bit more of an optimistic understanding of the phenomenon than we originally thought.
Well, of course, resilience and grit are those types of characteristics that we really strive for as humans. I'm wondering, when you look at that resilience, how does animal behavior shift when there's like overpopulation or habitat loss or climate change? Does that affect animal behavior and decision making?
Absolutely. One issue that's out there is whether animals that have these behaviors that have a genetic basis, so there's a genetic basis, and natural selection over millions of years has favored these particular ways that animals behave. And when humans impose new novel constraints in the environment, one challenge for animals is to be able to keep up. And sometimes they're unable to just through natural selection change what they're doing, but behavioral flexibility, that grit, being able to shift on a dime or with new circumstances, really creates some opportunities for some species, and other species are more harmed, I think, by these rapid shifts.
I want to return to the dogs for just a moment and talk a bit more about, you know, a dog's breed. Does a dog's breed change its behavior, and how so? What do you see?
The students have found that a dog's breed is one of the clearest signals in influencing their ability to communicate with humans and to solve problems. What we're finding is that working dogs, dogs that have been favored to, you know, do a task in coordination with humans, those are the dogs that tend to do really, really well at understanding human social cues. Toy dogs, we can pick them up, we can, you know, carry them around and so forth. And as adorable as they are, they're not quite as good at looking at these human cues as are the herding dogs or the working dogs.
There's human cues, and then I'm wondering the cues from other dogs. Like how, you know, do the studies reveal like how they deal with unequal rewards when one dog gets more than another, or how dogs cooperate with each other to work together? What do you see there?
That is an excellent question. This is not my work, but people have certainly looked at inequity aversion. So whether dogs respond negatively if one dog gets more of a treat than another, and they absolutely do. There are very few species out there where people have documented this phenomenon of understanding whether things are equal or not. And dogs 100% do. They're very tuned in to the worlds of their fellow canine companions. They also make decisions on how much humans share with others. So think of yourself, maybe you're at the kitchen table right now, enjoying a bowl of cereal. One person might be generous and sharing food with other humans. The other person may be less likely to drop food on the ground and whatnot. And it turns out that dogs, through careful experimental tests, can eavesdrop on how generous humans are to each other and make decisions to, you know, go over to the person that's going to share food potentially with another human and make the leap that it's going to also get food given to itself.
Wow, that is complex. There is strategy there. UW Eau Claire behavioral ecologist and evolutionary biologist Jen Smith here studies the decision-making of social mammals. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the social lives of mammals, their structures, how it informs human systems. A new animal behavior course underway at UW Eau Claire. Call in with questions about the social lives of animals, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology and a behavioral ecologist at UW Eau Claire. Jen, your students are studying inequality in social mammals. Help us understand that. What types of inequality exist among social mammals?
Right. That is a great question. And one of the things we're doing is we're looking across lots and lots of species of mammals. So if they're social, that means that they're spending time together, repeated interactions with each other. And some animals are more equitable in sharing than others. One of the phenomena that we've been studying is privilege and trying to think about the ways that non-human animals will preferentially privilege some individuals over others. And we're looking at these commodities, so something outside of the body of an animal that can be transferred from one generation to another. So for example, red squirrels up in Alaska, they have these big middens where they put many, many, many pine cones together. And a mother will generate this large stack of pine cones, this resource, this wealth, and she'll actually transfer it to some squirrel offspring, but not others.
Wow.
And that, yeah, it influences their survival, their reproduction, all of these commodities that are really important for evolutionary outcomes.
And that those differences in intergenerational wealth, you know, for social animals, it's so interesting. It can be many different things. I mean, there was one study that looked at the passing on tools for cracking nuts and what that can mean for offspring and future generations. Can you, you know, we're also looking that in the human world very seriously. Where are the parallels?
There are very striking parallels. And in fact, the work that we're doing was motivated by ways that anthropologists have studied human societies and the way that wealth can be transferred. And we use that exact same lens for thinking about, okay, do we actually see physical commodities being transferred one generation to another? Do we see social wealth being transferred? And in human societies, social networks are one of the strongest predictors of health outcomes. So having a tight social network, having support systems are incredibly important in humans. And it turns out in non-human animals, this is true as well.
how do you, or if you can guess, how do animals react to this inequality? Do they understand their place, so to speak, or do they notice it?
Well, one of the pieces that we're working on right now, we're creating this whole special issue with Philosophical Transactions, Royal Society B, and we're looking at inequality. And the paper that I'm working on with UW Claire students is to actually look at the balance between equality and inequality and mechanisms that animals use to promote equality in these situations that might be viewed as unequal. And they do a lot of different mechanisms. So they have peacekeeping. So if they have a fight, many animals will make up. They, you know, chimpanzees will kiss each other, bonobos, which are related to us as well, other apes, they hug after a fight. Even the dogs that we were just talking about, they have various ways of making up to repair relationships. So if there is something unequal, they have ways to level that in the long run and promote sharing.
Talking with Jen Smith, assistant professor and behavioral ecologist at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in with your questions about animal behavior, 800-642-1234. Tyler wrote to ask, three-year-old corgi and a five-year-old cat's their best friends, and the cat, who tends to push things off the counter for attention, seems to have figured out which thing is a dog treat box. And Tyler has discovered multiple times pushing the cat pushing the box off the counter, causing it to crash, opening up, spilling treats over the ground, and is wondering, do you think it's possible the cat is working with Finley to take control of the food supplies?
Oh, Tyler, that is amazing. And Finley, well done. That is incredible. So absolutely, these partnerships between members of different species are by no means limited just to humans and our pets, but pets can actually establish relationships with one another. And there are even some, small lines of evidence that domesticated pets can form relationships with wild animals as well. Somewhat dangerous encounters between large cats, so a little bit larger than the cat you're describing, like lions, can actually form partnerships with domestic dogs out in, for example, Kenya, where I did my PhD work. So I think these sort of trickster collaborations are pretty interesting. Are pets at home, like humans, maybe, you know, we were locked down during early COVID days, can get bored. And so they innovate, they have different ways that they can create a more stimulating environment. And it sounds like by by doing this, they you know, it's a win-win. And I'm sure the dog is really excited to have this feeding opportunity.
Well, I think we're getting to your favorite part of the conversation, which is squirrels, because you're a leader in ground squirrel research. What can you tell us about your long-term studies of California ground squirrels?
Oh, gosh. So every summer, I bring students to Briones Regional Park, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And yeah, we've been doing this long-term study for the last decade on individually marked squirrels and are looking at their personalities, their social networks, the ways that they throw dirt and form coalitions against rattlesnakes. And they're just such incredible, bold animals. And kind of going back to what we started with, this idea about, you know, ways humans are influencing various species. I think squirrels, because of their adaptability, their flexibility, they're one of the species that are actually doing pretty well in the face of humans.
At the end of the semester, you're bringing students to California. What will the students be researching about ground squirrels?
They'll be doing some of the baseline data collection, which is monitoring who the moms, the dads are, marking the young of the year. So they'll be doing that piece, and then they'll be adding a new piece to the project, which is to see how well these squirrels can solve a puzzle box. The puzzle box is a touchscreen computer, and we train one squirrel to be able to figure out the puzzle. If they do it, they get a food item, major theme for today. And we're then asking whether the idea of solving that puzzle can be transferred by observing a really smart squirrel solving that puzzle, and whether that varies based on if the squirrels are exposed to humans or if they're in a more naturalistic setting.
Wow. Jen, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Jen Smith is an assistant professor of biology at UW-Eau Claire. Research aims to understand decision-making in social mammals. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a comedian's search for humor in tragedy.
A house fire is a tragic thing to live through, and comedian J.C. Catlin would agree. He's done it. But in his new short film, he also proves that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
My name is J.C. Catlin. I wrote and am the star of everything I learned when my house burned down, and I am a comedian.
It only takes a few hours for your house to burn down, but after that, you continue to live inside its burnt-out husk for months and years. When my house in rural Wisconsin burned down, it was the coldest day of the year.
JC had fired up the seldom-used wood stove in the basement to help keep his family warm.
And then all of a sudden I thought, you know, that's smelling kind of strong, and so I got up. And all of a sudden heard my kids screaming. And by the time I got into the living room, there was already like flames shooting up through the floor.
He managed to put the fire out briefly with one of his fire extinguishers. But as he went to grab another, the fire reignited and quickly grew.
So I just kind of like called 911 and ran away, you know, thinking the propane tank is going to explode or something. Like you want to get away from the house because it was already just totally engulfed in flames.
Everyone made it out safely and managed to stay warm, even the hamster.
When you're grabbing the cup, walking out with the hamster cage, putting it in the back of the car, you know it's bad.
A couple days later, he went back and posted a video to YouTube of the aftermath.
It somehow has turned into a cave. Typically, houses, when they burn down, don't turn into a cave. But in this case, my house decided that it would. So I thought that while it's still cold and the caveness is preserved, that we really have to document this because it is important to remember in these times of loss that something new and beautiful always is left in the ashes. And in this case, it's stalactites and stalagmites, my two favorite kind of stalag things.
So the water from the firefighters' hoses was freezing to the ceiling from the cold, melting from the fire, and then refreezing on tables, counters, and floors.
Which was, you know, kind of oddly beautiful, but also, you know, when it's your own house, it's just kind of like, it's pretty heavy imagery.
Considering how tragic the fire was, the YouTube video was actually kind of funny in places. JC says he wasn't really going for humor, but it got him thinking. And that's where his friend Joe comes in.
My name is Joe Pickett. I'm the director of Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, and also the curator of the Found Footage Festival.
Jokes are how JC and Joe both make a living. So finding some humor in the fire came naturally to them.
Takes the edge off, you know, and sometimes it's necessary to get through these things any way you can.
I think laughing at tragedy is a uniquely Wisconsin thing. And for this film, we're really trying to strike the balance between like, yeah, this is a tragic thing and we shouldn't just be laughing at it. But then it's also like, this is how we deal with it.
So they filmed JC inside the burned house like he was still living there.
that's the conceit of the short, is that we wanted JC to go about his normal day-to-day routine in the burnt out house. So yeah, he's vacuuming, he's listening to extremely warped records that don't play on a record player anymore.
Hi, is this the library? Yeah, what's your policy on, like, if the books are, you know, a little bit, like, on fire?
JC says in the film that things get better, but sometimes it's hard to notice. 2 years later, he's still dealing with it.
Going through and, you know, remembering, oh, we don't have a grapefruit spoon. We got to buy a grapefruit spoon. That's every single day. You know, there's just something that you don't have that you used to have, and then you assume it's somewhere because you used to have one. Oh, no, we don't. It burned in the fire. You know, so that still goes on all the time.
For more on Everything I Learned When My House Burned Down, a comedy, you can visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Thanks, guys.
Sweet.
Great.
Thanks.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We sample some traditional and contemporary folk music now, learning about musicians making their mark on the genre. Call in with questions about folk music. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Oh, Sheila Shigley is here, hosts Wisconsin Public Radio's Simply Folk. The program airs Sunday evenings 5 to 8 on the Ideas Network and the NPR News and Music Network stations. Sheila, welcome back.
Hello, Kate. It is great to be here with you.
Oh, well, take us into the life and times of folk music. What are you exploring now and more deeply this year?
Right. There has been an explosion of live performances. So, but not only is my inbox full of CDs, like self-produced CDs, professionally produced CDs, but now we have just like dozens and dozens, probably hundreds actually, of concerts coming up just in our own state, let alone beyond the borders. So,
I wonder, was that pent-up COVID, do you think?
I think pent-up COVID, for sure. And I will say that from what I observed, musicians often didn't stop playing. They would just play in their homes and like turn on the Zoom, and it just kept on going. I have a good friend here in Madison who is a well-known Wisconsin musician, Dahi Wolf, and he did something like 100 straight days of, and he would just play a traditional tune and explain it, and that was like his service to keep people occupied during the harder times. So,
wow, what innovations are you noticing in folk music as you hear this new wave of music?
Yes. I mean, it's been innovative almost by design. I mean, there was a time when the fiddle was considered revolutionary. Like, you're playing what? That used to be the pipes, let's say in Irish music, the bagpipes. And somebody brought in a fiddle, and that was considered, wow, what are you doing, brother? That is not okay. And now, of course, we can't think of Irish music without thinking of fiddle. And so it started out innovative to begin with, but now, as we'll see with some of the music samples we're going to play this morning, they're going a lot farther out on the limb.
Well, let's hear from a Wisconsin Celtic artist, and this is Liesl Wilson from the Ashland Bayfield area. Oh my goodness. Beautiful. So fiddler, vocalist, erhuist.
Right. She plays. I know her as a wild fiddler and obviously an amazing singer. I mean, there are a few singers that we tend to hold up in the Celtic side of the folk community. One of those is Karen Matheson from the Scottish group Capercaillie. But when I met Liesl, I was like, I'm in the presence of greatness. We have our very own Karen Matheson right here in Wisconsin, and she's hiding out up north, and we want to get her out there more. But she busted out an erhu for one of our sessions together and just started playing Scottish fiddle tunes on the vertical Chinese instrument called the erhu, and it just blew me away, and I'm like, this is amazing.
And she speaks all these languages as well, so she's singing in these different languages.
Right. She speaks beautiful Gaelic, Irish, and Scottish Gaelic, and she sings in Welsh, and she sings in Mandarin.
Wow. And so that gives her an ability to do such a range of things in folk music, I'd imagine.
It does. And at first it might seem unusual when you think about it, and especially when you hear the instruments together. And even just hearing that song just now, the way she was singing, there are so many similarities between traditional musics around the world. And I sometimes think that we're surprised when we hear the similarities. And actually, it's just that many of us were raised on very formal classical music, and you find out that if you step back from that, other musics have a lot in common just by nature from their roots.
We're going to move on here. You've been listening to a lot of Roseanne Cash's cover of Time by Tom Waits. Let's take a listen.
She said she'd stick around till the bandages came off, but these mama's boys just don't know when to quit. And Matilda asked the sailors, are those dreams or are those prayers? Close your eyes, son, and this won't hurt a bit. And it's time, time, time. It's time, time, time. It's time.
Oh. Just beautiful. My grandma's name is Matilda. I love that little tiny line there.
Yes.
So what draws you to this?
Well, you know, it's actually what you just said is part of what is so magical. I have been reading up on this song because I only just found it. And that happens, right? Something mm-hmm. can be out for a few years and I just found it. It means something different to everybody. You picked out Matilda. Mm-hmm. I picked out something else the other day, the magic of a great song is that it can mean 100 different things to 100 different people, and every single one of them is correct and applicable.
It just to the word, the repetition of time. And, you know, we always think about it, the change of seasons. I always think about time and the passage of it and then how slow it takes to get to that next season, but how fast time is going. And so I really, that, you know, when I hear the repetition in her voice there, that's what I also think about.
Yes, and that's the poetry of Tom Waits, right? We have several musicians well known to us all, I think, who are very often held up as almost like the American singer, the American composer. And I think actually Tom Waits should be at the top of that list personally, because he has this way of just getting right straight to your gut.
How do you feel about covers in general in the folk music tradition?
I think it is wonderful and it's a great honor. You know, it's unselfish, right? I mean, who doesn't want to write their own song and just sing their own song? But as you'll see, if you get a hold of this album, it's called Women Sing Waits. It means so much to these lady singers, and they're all famous in their own right. Mm-hmm. And they want to cover this song because it's just simply a beautiful song written by a beautiful poet, and it's an honor to sing it. It doesn't have to be something you created or claim.
Sheila Shigley is the host of Simply Folk on WPR. Call in with questions and comments about folk music, how it makes you feel, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we explore the folk music tradition and the emerging artists who are making their mark on a wide variety of styles with WPR's host of Simply Folk. Sheila Shigley is here. Call in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sheila, you mentioned the outdoor concert season. When does it typically start? Where should we look for those folk influences in the outdoors?
Well, it's already started, I can say, from personal experience, having played in 16 degrees a few weeks ago some very hardy people dancing in parkas. It was a little much, even for Wisconsin, but I was so proud of them. I'm like, yes, we do have an audience. They're in parkas and they're dancing. So technically, it's already started. You know, St. Patrick's Day really kind of kicks things off.
Naturally.
I would say we're pretty close to starting to see more outdoor performances. Certainly in the next 2 to 3 weeks, they'll start just blossoming, and then it won't stop until the snow starts again. So,
well, we're gonna hear more music here. There is a large celebration of Irish and Celtic music, Irish Fest in Milwaukee, and this year it is Doolin, and we're gonna hear some of Doolin's music from a live performance recording. Well, now we've arrived in Ireland.
Now we've arrived.
We're officially here. Yes. Wheels down in Ireland. Doolin being, I learned, on the southwest coast of Ireland. Have you been there?
I have not yet.
Okay.
I have not yet. And yes, they named themselves after that town. That's actually two groups of French brothers. You know, Celtic music has taken Europe by storm, and they fell in love with the town of Doolin that you just mentioned and decided. I believe one of their explanations was that because France doesn't have good beer, they wanted to name themselves after the place they had the best beer when they were touring, and it was Doolin.
Fair.
Yeah. But they're French brothers, and of course, France has its own Celtic tradition with the Breton music, but these folks really like to concentrate on a lot of Irish, and they sing. The vocals are just amazing. They'll be appearing at Milwaukee Irish Fest, which is actually the largest Irish festival. It's the largest Irish music festival in the world, right here,
wow,
right in Milwaukee.
What is it like?
Bring good shoes. There's a reason that they have coin-operated foot massagers at the far ends of the park. It's, you know, it's a big concrete thing, and you'll just race back and forth all day long to great musical performances. It's a wonderful, wonderful time.
So there are multiple stages set up, and you can kind of just flock to each one and take it all in.
Yes, and one of the hidden treasures I like to point out, it's called the Cultural Village. So it's hard to even find the schedule for that. You'll see all the big stages on the schedule. Be sure to check out the Cultural Village, because that is where you will find really deeply traditional singers hiding out in this little tent, and they'll be singing for an enraptured audience. Often the audience itself is directly from Ireland, and these are like some of the last remaining folk singers from the old tradition.
Oh, what a great tip. We heard from Jean and Madison called in, and Jean wants to let people know that there's also an Irish Fest in Madison on May 21st at Garver Feed Mill.
There is. It's the first one to be held at Garver, and it's going to be a lot of fun. One of the musicians that will be coming in is Winifred Horan. People who are listening may know of the wonderful supergroup Solas that just retired a few years ago. Winifred has her own project now called Redemption Road, and she'll be appearing at that festival. Is that kind of one of the highlights?
Oh, wow. Okay. That's awesome. So I can't wait to get to this one. You appreciate this album project called The Music Tarot. And this is from Wisconsin musician Lori Madsen and producer Brian Daly. Let's take a listen.
I can breathe.
Musical tarot readings. Tell us.
The musical tarot. Well, the artist and composer and performer was going through a very difficult health period of health that was really, really, really hard. And she decided to drop everything she was doing and create a project where she would write a song for each card in the tarot deck. And I was just floored when I first heard it. And there are more songs coming, but she has released some now under the project name, which is The Musical Tarot.
Wow, that is really amazing. And she's really used music to work through these medical issues. I mean, she speaks really openly also about migraine headaches.
Right, right. And it just, to have that strength, first of all, to even be able to compose and produce at all when you're going through something. It's hard enough when you're not going through anything, but then to produce something of this depth. And, you know, honestly, it reminds me a little bit of the Tom Waits material in that it's just grabs you. Mm. It's such direct language. And then when you pair it with those sweet melodies, it's just almost like devastatingly beautiful. That's how I experienced it anyway.
It's almost like a diary with music in a way, telling someone's journey through their medical
scare.
Yes,
it's so open and so honest and so beautifully produced. Wisconsin's own Brian Daly took on the project and also plays on it himself.
Talking about folk music with Sheila Shigley, host of WPR's Simply Folk. Still time to talk about the folk music that moves you. 800-642-1234. Sheila, Simply Folk periodically features songs requested by listeners. I know this is your favorite show, listener request. What songs are often requested?
Well, as it happens, I do have an anecdote, and I'll keep it very short. Everybody listening probably knows that the song Waltzing with Bears is often requested. And we just lost our dear Robbie Clement, who was the one we play the most performing that song. I was out recently and I had only two people approach me about Simply Folk. The first one said, I wish you would play more Waltzing with Bears. I just love it every time that comes on. And at the end of the gathering, a second person came up to me and said, I have to confess that when Waltzing with Bears comes on, that's when we turn it off. I'm like, you know, this is the folk process. It's a wide umbrella and you can have these two extremes. They coexist and that is folk music.
Is there a listener request show coming up?
We just had one last Sunday. It'll be the second Sunday in May. So it's not too late to get in your requests. We will try our hardest to gather them up.
I wonder, do requests build on each other? Do you sometimes find themes where someone discovers something and then you move in that type of direction for a while?
Yes, I learn so much. As I mentioned, there are songs we play quite a lot, but every single request show, there's something new where I go, okay, I don't know it all. I haven't learned it all. Didn't even know we had this in our library.
I was about to say, and it's in the music library.
It's in the music library. So it's always just, it surprises me every time, even though I know it shouldn't anymore.
Oh, Sheila, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Sheila Shigley is host of WPR's Simply Folk. The program airs Sunday evenings from 5 to 8 on the Ideas Network and the NPR News and Music Network stations. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.